Welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is Joshua Trevino of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Pay attention, because I will transmit this to Vladimir. Now, here's the Tribcast.
Thank you, Josh Trevino.
The party switching Josh Trevino.
I was going to say, isn't he a Democrat now?
Yes, fresh off of his April Fool's Day joke,
in which
he pretended to switch to the Democratic Party.
It looked like he found out who his actual friends were during that little twit festival on Sunday.
Did you notice that he said it was a joke also on April Fool's Day?
Yeah.
Meaning what? It could have been a
Maybe
joke
that
it
was the joke.
It's a double agent?
Yeah. I'm just saying, anyone fall for it? Jay?
No, I didn't pay attention to that.
Jay has no idea what we're talking about.
Jay is above the Twitter.
Jay had a life.
No, I just sometimes I'll like, you know, look at Twitter every 10 seconds, and sometimes I'll go for several days without even firing it up.
A Twitter drought.
Well, let's not get too deep into that.
I got a tweet of my four-year anniversary yesterday. My fourth anniversary on Twitter.
Oh.
I thought you were talking about your wedding anniversary.
You've been with your wife much longer than that, Russ.
No, it's just my Twitter account.
All right, this has really gone off the rails. Let's start over.
Who's in charge?
Hello, I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the first week of April. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Reporter Emily Ramshaw. Oh, no. Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Kind of thought you were saying, oh, no, because I was on a podcast. Jeez. Hello there.
And reporter Jay Root.
Otherwise known as
the Golden
Voice. Mr. Root.
He makes us do this every week.
I do. It's getting old.
Old Golden Voice Root.
I think the audience ought to decide if it's golden.
I may not like what they decide.
Oh, we could get this out of the way right now. If you have comments on Jay's voice, send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. Usually we say that at the end of the thing. But
be nice. Please.
He says in his gentlest voice.
Don't hurt me.
Yeah, it didn't sound so golden when you were up against it.
Butter.
What?
You remember that.
Anyway. We're going to talk about Michael Quinn Sullivan and the situation he finds himself in.
The situation, okay.
Yeah, stay tuned. We're going to talk about checking on the presidential race and see what role Texas might play. We'll talk about where the money for the women's health program is going to come from, and then we'll see how much time we have left. And then we'll just drone on for a few minutes to fill up the time.
Campus carry.
That might be what we talk about if we have time.
We'll see if we have enough
time. But first, I have to say that this episode of the Tribcast was brought to you by Opportunity Days, the shared plan for regional opportunity at the University of Texas at El Paso, which is happening from May 2nd through the 3rd. So go to El Paso and check that out then. Right. Let's start with Michael Quinn Sullivan. So a couple lawmakers filed ethics complaints against Michael Quinn Sullivan. Maybe, Ross, you could provide us with some quick backstory on who Michael Quinn Sullivan is this matters.
Yeah, there's two complaints filed against Michael Quinn Sullivan, who's a conservative activist in Austin and who runs something called Empower Texans, an affiliated group called Texans for Fiscal Responsibility, and another affiliated group called the Empower Texans PAC. He's he's a gadfly with some money, and he's been really effective in getting the Republicans to polarize on issues that are of interest to him and his group. So, you know, he jumped into the speaker's race in a really big way. He jumped into the fight during the last session over the rainy day fund in a really big way. A couple of legislators who've been his foils in campaigns, Vicky Truitt of Southlake and Jim Keffer of Eastland, filed complaints with the Texas Ethics Commission, basically saying he's not registered as a lobbyist, although he has lobbied, and Empower Texans, the umbrella group, is improperly acting as a political action committee when it's registered as a nonprofit. And those complaints now reside with the Texas Ethics Commission. Sullivan has said his response to this was he hadn't read the complaints when we talked to him, but he said that he believes that, you know, this is basically baseless and that basically he's got these guys on the run and this is their response to that.
Does this have any more teeth than just disgruntled victims of his attacks?
Well, I mean, it could. If, for example, the claims that the group has been making illegal campaign contributions turns out to be true, you can take that to court as a civil charge, and the people against whom the group spent money would be entitled, with a proper verdict, to triple damages. You know, this happened with Chris Bell during the 2008 governor's race. 2006 governor's race, when Rick Perry's campaign spent some money against him that they hadn't properly reported, and Bell got a huge check. I don't remember the amount of money, but got a huge check because, under this triple damages thing. So you know, what's more interesting in an immediate sense is that we're 50 or 60 days before a primary election, and does this put a hesitation in his step? I mean, he's been playing in a bunch of elections, including, I think he's endorsed already, Vicky Truitt's opponent. Does this make him hesitate?
I mean, where do you draw the line in Texas between being a lobbyist versus being a consultant? I mean, I feel like there's this whole class of people in Austin who don't register as lobbyists, but are still very, you know, common figures around the Capitol. You know, they have their hands in these issues. How do you determine whether you're a lobbyist or something else?
Well, I mean, this is a great topic of conversation in the lobby, and the people who are registered as lobbyists think that some of the political consultants have taken unfair advantage of their access to the members that they helped to elect. But basically, lobbying is when you take money from somebody to try to influence legislators or regulators to do something on behalf of that client. And what these are alleging is that the people who are involved in financing Empower Texans, mostly the Dunn family out of Tim Dunn and his family out of Midland, have been basically paying Michael Quinn Sullivan to advocate for issues before the legislature, and that he hasn't registered as a lobbyist when he's over there advocating. He's over there making direct contact, asking for direct results, for direct votes, those kinds of things. These complaints contend that that's lobbying.
And he's not even considered a consultant, right? I mean, he's sort of a guy with a scorecard.
Well, yeah, but you can be an outsider and say, you know, you can be a political activist and say, you know, I organize rallies, or I'm involved in the Tea Party, or I'm involved in whatever it is, and you don't have to register as a lobbyist. But if you're advocating on particular issues or on particular votes before the legislature, certain kinds of votes, you do have to register. He's operated for a long time in, you know, an area that's, you know, it's not necessarily, these laws aren't necessarily black and white. And I think what's going to be the interesting next step is when he gets to the point where he needs to offer a defense. What exactly is that defense? Maybe that we're not lobbyists because of X, Y, and Z. We're not a political organization because of X, Y, and Z. But we're not to that point in the conversation yet.
I just think if he comes under fire for this, that there's a whole class of, you know, protected people, you know, who would also fall into this category.
I think that's possible. You know, the King Street Patriots just went to out of Houston, just lost a court case in Austin over whether they, as a nonprofit group, had stepped over the line and into becoming a general political action committee, which is what the judge said. They're appealing that. But there are a lot of people that are sort of operating in this gray area.
Why didn't he just register as a lobbyist? Did you ever ask him that? Because I've run into different people who don't consider themselves lobbyists, but just out of an abundance of caution, they do it. And you know, if you're in that field and you're at the Capitol and you're in a high contact sport,
right?
You know, I guess the question is not so much in that individual case, but is there any downside to registering as a lobbyist? I mean, you have to pay for it, but
the question
that,
in his case, and he hasn't, you know, we haven't talked about it yet, but the question in his case is, why did you stop registering as a lobbyist?
He was registered
as a lobbyist and then stopped filing. So it may be that he felt like the issues that he was talking about weren't issues where he needed to. I'm sure he probably had some reason for registering in the way that he did, or for not registering in the way that he did, but you know, we haven't had a full airing of that.
We are hearing more Republican politicians sort of speak out directly against him, they all happen to be, I think, sort of people that he's targeting.
Well, he's effective. I mean, he's driving them crazy. I mean, you know, whether you're with him or against him, you got to look at this guy and say, this guy has figured out how to get all the horses in the corral to run to the other side. I mean, he's figured out how to move the legislature on quick votes and on emotional votes and on things that involve the public, and how to get the public engaged in a way, or at least some part of the public engaged in a way, that they call these guys and pester them. I think that a lot of what they're doing is out of their own irritation with this guy steering them around.
So is that, you would see this as evidence of strength, not of people seeing him as sort of this growing force sort of against him that hasn't been there before?
I think he's been controversial with these guys for a long time.
Oh, I think that they absolutely loathe him, and they live in fear of his scorecards. You can't help but notice that they're not fighting back at him on the issues. They're really
right.
Not. I mean,
That's
this
right.
is all about you you know, didn't cross your I's and or didn't, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's, or you did some kind of paperwork wrong or whatever. I mean, and it maybe there's merit to it. I mean, if some nonprofit entity made a contribution and they're not allowed to, well, then, you know, then you get in trouble for that. But I think it's interesting that they don't really engage him directly and say your scorecard is ridiculous and, you know, the criteria you're using is bad and we actually are for this government program that you think we ought to cut. I mean, you don't see any of that.
Well, right. It's dangerous because his rhetoric is so powerful. I mean, and his reach has become so broad. I mean, you know, I think one of the questions this raises is this actually sort of mobilizing the more sort of moderate Republicans in a way that they haven't sort of been forced to mobilize as a group before?
Well, look how, I mean, we've all been around the legislature. We've all been around the Capitol. How many times have you had conversations with moderate Republicans who are like, you know, I really wish I could vote against this, but I can't. So it is interesting that they are there's at least some manifestation of their frustration coming out in the open a little bit, but for the most part, there's a very large group of moderates. It's probably larger even than the conservatives, but they're afraid to talk about it.
You saw it through with in the you know, family planning funding debate. I mean, there were so many moderate Republicans who were saying, "Look, I can't risk a no vote on something like this, even if I don't agree with it."
Well, and you got to give the other side their due. I mean, if I've got my opponent scared to act, I'm winning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's sort of the extension of the sort of Norquistification of politics, right? Where everything's very simple and there's no room for discussion of nuance.
Well, yeah, but if you don't believe that those nuances are appropriate, I mean, if you believe that this is, you know, you ought to be in our position on XYZ, anything I can do legally to get them into our position on XYZ is, you know, what I should be doing. I mean, one of the interesting things here is how small a group can do this now. This is basically Michael Quinn Sullivan and a couple of assistants.
But is it that they are that strong and effective, or is it that this is really how voters feel in Texas? I mean, you know, if moderate Republicans who are holding office are you know, too afraid to go against him because they think it's going to affect the outcome of their races, I mean, maybe their voters are more conservative, far more conservative than they are.
Right, right. Maybe they're wrong. I mean, that's where your fear comes from, right, is that you're in the wrong position.
Well, also, it also depends on, you know, if you think that, is it the voters telling the people with the scorecards what they want on it, or is it the people with the scorecards telling the voters what they should want on it? You know, it's sort of a power of suggestion issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of voters, will they, when they go to cast their votes on May 29th, have any effect on the presidential race at all?
It's looking less and less likely, frankly. Yeah, unfortunately.
Jay has a sad smile on his face.
I really would like to cover. I loved covering the 2008 SmackDown between Hillary and Obama, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But I think if the Texas primary were held, you know, 2 weeks from now instead of at the end of May. That, yeah, you know, that it could actually have an impact on the way people look at the Romney versus Santorum race. But, you know, he had a good night last night.
Romney did.
Yeah, Romney did. He won Wisconsin, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. Santorum thinks he's going to have a good May. There are definitely. If May had been in, you know, if the May contests were held in April instead of the other way around, I think we would all be talking about this still being a competitive race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kentucky and Arkansas hold their primary 1 week before the Texas primary. So there's a likelihood, I think, that Santorum will do better in May than he will in April, even at the time that, you know, you sort of see this rallying around Mitt Romney. George H.W. Bush, who already said he was supporting him, has re-endorsed him publicly in Houston. Jeb Bush endorsed him. So that, you know, you really are starting to see this train leaving the station, and nobody has a chance to reach him, which is going to really have a big impact in Texas, because the difference between having a very competitive or even a slightly competitive presidential election and not having one, you know, can really change turnout. And even though it's a cliche, you know, every election that you cover as a reporter, you know, the day before and you're writing your stories, you know, you quote all these strategists saying it's all about turnout, and it really is. It's who is turning out to vote. So,
well, and people like a fight. They like the conflict.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I just saw that the AP this afternoon, you know, basically effectively called it for Romney. I mean, said that the lead was now insurmountable.
But can he get to the necessary delegates to clinch the nomination?
That's what is really interesting too, is that, you know, there's still a very outside chance, I guess, that you could have they might be counting the superdelegates with that, which is can be semi-controversial in the sense that, you know, no primary is binding them to the result, and so you have, you know, just ordinary, not ordinary, but, you know, powerful elected officials or whatever who are superdelegates who would have publicly committed to Romney, which would give him, you know, the ability to go into the convention and claim a majority of the delegates, even though not all of them would necessarily have come from, you know, the voters having bestowed it. You know, I just did this story on the Texas primary, and it's really interesting. We forget about it, but we didn't really have presidential primaries in Texas until 1976. Right. And it's so complicated, and you just wonder why it has to be so complicated. But we've overlaid this primary system on, you know, on top of the old, you know, the delegate selection process, which used to be in sort of caucuses and like an intra, you know, party affair. And I think average voters sort of expect that when they go to the polls and they pick somebody, that that's what's deciding it. But really, it's not. It's much more of a hybrid system. I mean, particularly on the Democratic side, like 4 years ago, you know, half of them roughly are by caucus, and then half of them are roughly by primary. So.
Right. Right. So think how different this would have been if Rick Santorum had won the March 6th Texas primary.
Right.
Right. I mean, he was ahead in all the polls at that point. The whole momentum thing would have been completely different. I'm sure he's, you know, spitting at some of the Texas Republicans
exactly.
who delayed this thing.
Yeah. I mean, this, I think that the decision that the courts made on the Texas redistricting map actually did have an impact on the presidential race. I mean, I don't think that they were thinking about that, but it did definitely.
Right.
I think you could certainly make the case that it did.
Exactly. They've all been talking about how Texas, you know, too bad, so sad, Texas isn't going to get to have an effect on the presidential race.
Right.
But it already did.
Well, some Texas courts and politicians, not the voters, which is right.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean.
But both Ron Paul and Rick Santorum are very feverishly right now trying to – because of the delayed primary, the delegate selection process is beginning before the primary, which it's usually primary night. You know, you stick around, you participate in these caucuses, then you end up going to these district conventions and culminating in the state convention, and then out of that state convention, people select delegates to go to the national convention. Well, we got to select the delegates before that because the primary is so late, and Santorum and Paul are feverishly trying to get these delegates, because if it does go to a disputed convention in Tampa, then the loyalty of the delegates themselves will actually matter, because if there's a first ballot and, say, Mitt Romney didn't get there, then on the second ballot, all these people, these 155 delegates, or 152 because three of them are superdelegates, but they could switch to whoever they want. And if your people are there, well, then you've got a leg up. So they still think that's evidence right there that the candidates themselves, they may be delusional, they still think right. that there's a possibility of a brokered convention, and they're doing everything they can to increase the, you know, their power in that event.
So when do we know all of this? Do we know all this on primary day, or do we know this a week later when the conventions go in, or
in terms of who,
how the delegates split and everything from Texas?
On the Republican side, it's not the same on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, it's 152 of them are allocated by the primary. So, you know, soon thereafter, you know, whatever. But there's another thing that's weird. Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain are still on the ballot.
So is John Huntsman.
Huntsman? Okay, yeah. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Huntsman. And there's also uncommitted. So Republican primary voters can select uncommitted, and then but anyway, we'll know that, you know, soon after. I mean, I guess that night, you know, who got what, and there'll be estimates, and then, you know, after, that's what makes it so frustrating in a way. It's like, you know, what you found out. I mean, you know, 4 years ago on primary night, it was one thing, we thought one thing, and then it took several weeks for us to figure out who actually won the 08 primary, and it was actually a split deal. I think Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and
Obama won the caucuses.
Obama won more, actually won more delegates.
But that was part of because of the Democrats' unique setup.
Yeah, the Democrats have a different setup than the Republicans do.
Which I'm sure they'll debate at their state convention coming up soon.
Well, I think both the conventions this year are going to look at what the results that they got this year, like they did in 2008, and say, whoa, let's redo this. Mm-hmm. The Republicans, I think a lot of Republicans are saying, I'm not sure we want this proportional allocation of delegates now. You know, they did that in order to take all of the election away from the early states. And I think the candidates are going, you know, you've turned this into a episode of Survivor.
Which was a hit show.
Oh, you're talking about globally in terms of...
Well,
yeah,
but
yeah.
You got to do it state by state. You know,
right.
This proportional selection of delegates is, you know...
Right.
You know, the presidential candidates are going, you're killing me out here.
Yeah, well, I mean, they saw how the Democrats did it, so the Republicans changed it to get in on the game, and now it's like... Of course, this was like a perfect storm of a time to do it, too, because there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the front runner. I mean, it was...
Right.
It was a perfect storm to have this long, long, drawn-out contest. And there are a lot of states that never got to play a role that suddenly had attention and ads and visits by the candidates and all of that, that just like we did 4 years ago, you know, I remember just – I mean, I got to interview Barack Obama for 5 minutes and Hillary Clinton for about 4 minutes, and, you know, that seemed like a really big deal.
That doesn't sound like equal time.
Was that before or after Brad Watson's interview?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let's move on. Have you said enough?
That's your transition? That's it? That's a
segue? Jay taught me this on the last podcast.
Jay doesn't like transitions.
Jay said, just say now for something completely different.
Beep.
Yeah.
We're going to move on to the Women's Health Program.
Sure.
Which is not going to be the recipient of the federal money it is accustomed to.
Right. So the Women's Health Program, just catching you up, the Women's Health Program is about to lose about $30 million a year in federal funding. The program, basically, Perry has said, look, this program is going to continue as a state-funded program. We're going to find the money in our budget somewhere to fund this program. Well, we got the first look this week at where that money is actually going to be coming from, and it's pretty interesting. Basically, all these House Democrats wrote a letter to Tom Cease, the state's health commissioner, saying, so basically, where in the heck are you going to find this $30 million a year? Our budget sucks, to put it nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And Cease wrote back, you know, like a week and a half later in a document that the Democrats were all too happy to give out yesterday, that basically said, look, there are a lot of unrestricted federal block grants right now that we could draw down basically to pay for other programs so that we could move the state dollars from those programs to the state-run women's health program. So basically what he's saying is, you know, the feds have cut off the funding. Well, we may be able to sort of pull a fast one on the feds.
Trick the feds into funding the program that they don't want to fund.
Exactly. We'll get the feds to give us money for these other programs, and we'll just transfer those state dollars over to this. You know, he also said it's possible that they can find, you know, quote, efficiencies in existing programs that maybe aren't costing as much as they thought. You know, I think there's a little wiggle room there, but I think the reality is they think the best idea may be to try to pull down federal money for something else. In that case, you know, Perry and Cease would really get the last laugh because, you know, the feds have made this big stand about saying we're not going to fund this program because you're cutting out Planned Parenthood. Yet at the end, it may actually be an influx of federal dollars that allows them to keep this program operating without Planned Parenthood.
Doesn't it mean for at least a little while that they're using federal funds that were intended for other uses for this program?
It means that there are currently federal dollars that they have not applied for that could fund existing state programs. You know, I mean, and then there's a question right there that why the heck haven't we been drawing down this federal
money?
Why did
we cut all these other programs,
right? When we could have, you know, and the letter indicated basically that these are newly available sources of federal funds for
programs. Even if they're newly available, couldn't you draw them down and then, you know?
Well, that's what the Democrats argue is even if they're newly available, they should be pulling down these newly available dollars to sort of save money in the budget You know, and still accepting this $30 million. Basically, it's still $30 million a year you're not accepting from the federal government.
But aren't we still giving up this, like, unbelievable 9-to-1 match deal?
That's the argument, is that, right, this $30 million is basically coming to us, you know, for free. For every, you know, $1 the state was putting into this joint state-federal program, we were getting $9 from the federal government. It's one of the best matches of any, you know, matching program that the state has. So, you know, again, I think they sort of, if this is the route they end up going, it's pretty interesting, and it definitely does sort of give them the last laugh with the feds.
Well, does it? So the other question here was, if you cut out some of the providers, isn't there a question that even if you have enough money to pay for the services, that you don't have the provider network in place to do that?
So that's the argument. You know, the state, Perry's office basically says, look, there are thousands of these women's health program providers scattered all around the state. You know, we're just going to have to wait and see whether cutting out Planned Parenthood actually eliminates access. They say they don't think it will. You know, I think what's really questionable is that, yes, there are thousands of providers around the state enrolled in this program, but the reality is the overwhelming majority are like single doctor sites. Some of them actually look like they're just, you know, testing labs. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, you know, they're not the clinics that can see a huge, you know, throng of women at a time. So I think the question, it's really going to come down to, you know, how many more providers they can bring in, whether these doctors can really see the number of women that a Planned Parenthood clinic could see, and also how they advertise. I mean, how they let women in this program know that there's somewhere else for them to go. In the letter that C sent out this week, he sort of addressed that, said, you know, look, these locations will be on the website. They can call this phone number and find out, you know, another close location. You know, I think that the House Democrats who, you know, obviously they want Planned Parenthood to stay in the program, but barring that, I think they'd like to see a more concerted initiative to reach out to women who have been treated at Planned Parenthoods.
Let me put you on the spot a little bit. Do you know what percentage of these programs Planned Parenthood was providing? What percentage of these patients?
Yes. In the women's health program, 45% of women every year are treated by a Planned Parenthood clinic.
Okay.
That said, 85% of women in the program are treated at a clinic other than a Planned Parenthood every year. Now, I know those numbers don't add up. The reason is because...
We don't do math.
The reason is because women often go to more than one clinic for women's health program services every year. So they might go to one to get birth control, another for a well woman exam, and they're not always the same place.
So what part? How big a part of the network is Planned Parenthood?
Very large.
A third, a fourth, a half?
I think the number is that they receive, like, you know, 40% of the program's money every year. So they are seeing the most women, providing the most services of any single organization. Had been.
Is this necessarily Perry and C is getting the last laugh if sort of part of the argument is, you know, we don't need the feds and we can sort of go out and do this on our own, when really the fact is, to make it work, if you go this route, you do need the feds.
Right. And, you know, and then that is the other argument. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they have said very strongly that they don't, you know, we don't need federal assistance. We don't want federal assistance. You know, that said, I think they still, their argument will continue to be that, you know, we send all this money to Washington in our taxes, and that money is rightly ours.
Well, you know, there may be a PR, they get some PR advantage out of it, because they, like, we stuck it to the feds, we didn't bow down, we did our own program. And then, you know, it also may be that the attention span of the public is so short, and, you know, attention to the details is just too onerous. And so, you know, if a lot of people end up losing their health care, you know, we can talk about it all we want, but will there, you know, we've already got the highest number of uninsured, so...
Right, I mean, the superlatives aren't going to get worse. We're still basically...
Right,
you know,
so if, right. You know, worst. If 100,000 people lost health care, or, you know, and it's not going to be that many, let's say 50, I don't know, whatever it is it going to be a big enough deal? Is the story of all of this lost health care going to be what's going to drive it, or is it, you know... Perry with his bully pulpit saying we suck it to the feds.
Right. Or does the story become, you know, I think we're going to, it may be, the problem with this story is it may be a couple of years before we know
right.
any result. Well,
right.
All right, correction. It may be 9 months before we start seeing the results of some mm-hmm. of this. I
right.
mean, so.
Is that a pregnancy joke?
Yes, Reeve.
luckily, our.
So quick.
Yeah. our audience has a long attention span, and they've sat with us to this point.
Nine
now
months
it's time,
long?
We'll see. Yeah. Now it's time to say goodbye. On behalf of Jay, Emily, Ross, and Todd, who you can send your complaints about to tribcast@texastribune.org, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening. Could someone say something funny?
Yeah.
Why, we're not on tape yet.
Yes, we are.
Oh, we are.
That was good.
No, we are.
That'll do.
The podcast is over now. Yep. We're done.
That was the most depressing podcast ever.